This is Behind the Docs, the show that shines a spotlight on the people shaping how we understand and use technology. In each episode, we pull back the curtain to talk about what it's really like to create the docs we all rely on. Let's dive in.
Welcome to Behind the Docs. Today, we have a very special episode with Heretto's very own Jared Sickler. What's up, Jared?
Hey, Ren.
clearly we talk all the time and I probably know a lot of the things that you're going to tell me today, but I am always, if I can give you a platform, I will give you a platform. So today this is your platform. Of course.
Thanks.
So I ask everyone, what brought you to technical documentation and not necessarily Heretto, but you know, how did you get into this world?
Well, the story is, I mean, they're connected, how I ended up here and how I got into technical documentation. But the main way was stress. I was in grad school and we always would write our papers in Word or Google Docs, and they always have to be formatted for, you know, submission. So I would be dealing with the same problems that everybody has with Word or Google Docs. Like if you slide the margin bar because you need a list indented or, you know, an equation, I was working in logic and I would slide the bar and everything would just go haywire. And then I would spend the next like hour or two trying to figure out how to get it back. And I got really frustrated. And one of my friends in school was like, oh, you should use this program. It's called LaTeX. And if anybody tells you it's LaTeX, they're wrong. Anyway, so I was like, cool, what is it? And he kind of gave me a crash course in like 30 minutes. So I downloaded everything I needed to. It's this open source. A lot of physical sciences will use it because it makes equations look really pretty. You don't have to deal with it. So you just learn the markup language and write. And so as I was writing my term paper, I switched over and started using it. And it's a structured language, semi-structured language. So if you break a rule, then your paper will not generate into a PDF. That happened as I was two-thirds of the way through my paper. I couldn't get it to print a PDF, to typeset. And I was like, okay, I don't have time to learn this. So I'm going to go back to Word. So I copied and pasted everything back to Word. And then it was significantly more of a mess than so I was like, whatever, I'll just stick with it. And so I hunkered down one night and just read as much as I could and figured out where the error was. And then at that point, just never looked back. So then I started writing all my papers in that. I would take notes in class in that. And it was a lot nicer because if I needed to send notes to somebody, I could just send them this like pretty PDF that was done. So that was it. It's kind of crash course mid-semester.
Wow. And so how did that end up where, I mean, I don't think you were in grad school for technical writing, correct? So
no.
How did you end up in the industry?
So I was very stereotypically sitting at a coffee shop working on my philosophy papers, and Patrick and Casey, our co-founders, were sitting next to me. They would often come in and sit next to me because there was some the office apparently had some, like the sprinkler system went off, and it didn't actually go off in, I think, our office at the time. But the building was being maintenance, so they would come into the coffee shop and work. And so I was sitting there one day and Patrick looks over and I had no idea what their software was. He goes, is that LaTeX? And I was like, yeah, it's great. And I gave him basically like a sales pitch of why it was so awesome, not knowing, now I know him well enough. Like he gave me his smirk, which is like, he knows exactly what I'm saying, but he's going to keep letting me talk anyway, instead of being like, yeah, I know what it is. So I basically gave him a sales pitch. And then 3 years later, they asked me to join the team.
Wow. I didn't realize that there was 3 years in between that initial conversation and then joining the team.
I met them like my second or third semester at University of Rochester. And then, it wasn't until my fifth year in that program that Patrick reached out and was like, oh, hey, I've got a job. You should come do it.
Wild that a random coffee shop moment has led you to a career.
I mean, I was a personality hire, you know, I didn't know what I was doing. It was like, get in, see if you can learn it kind of situation. And I did. And it was, you know, learning a markup language and kind of my own time really helped to learn a highly structured language like Ditta. Now, there are all kinds of new principles I had to learn. Like, I didn't know what a Ditta map was when I came here. I barely could check my email at that point. So it was a lot of like, I'd leave work and I'd go home and I would just read and read as much as I could. And, you know, the learning curve, my father-in-law describes me as just a personality quirk, as he's like, you like to do life with a weight vest on. So like everything I do, I try to make it more difficult and more challenging. And he means it as a compliment. But when I learned Ditta for the first time, when I did the learning Ditta courses, I used a text editor. I didn't use our system and I didn't use another Ditta system. I just learned to write in the markup language in a text editor that wouldn't tell me if I did anything wrong. Then I would upload the files and then I would test them to see if they were valid or not. And it was a kind of painstaking way to do it, but it was really helpful because then using a system that would close tags for me automatically or check validation, I was pretty confident that as I was writing, I knew what was going on behind the scenes the whole time.
Wow. That's a very accurate description from your father-in-law, knowing after that, like, little tidbit. I didn't know that. And that's pretty intense.
I was curious, and you don't go on to do research and not be somebody who's like, I need to know everything about this, is at least as much as I can. So I was like, well, if I'm going to learn it, I need to learn it. Like, I need to understand exactly what's going on behind the scenes.
Fair, fair. So when you came on board, you were learning Ditta, you were like working for the team and all that stuff. When was the moment that you realized how important like technical documentation is? Like, was there a moment? And if so, what was it?
Well, there was for a long time at this company, if you were a customer success manager, you were also a de facto tech writer. And it was a twofold reason. One, we were a really, really small team at the time. And so we needed people to document everything that the developers were building. So we would function in that role. But it also played this other role of like, when we're managing customer accounts, we know exactly what people are doing because we use the system every day. So we could provide them advice and guidance. So I've heard this from potential customers recently even. They're like, you guys, it's clear you're practitioners. You're not just somebody who built a system that is supposed to do this thing. Like, you guys use it, you guys leverage it, you believe in it, you understand it. And that's something that we've maintained that ethos as much as possible, is like the people who are working in this system understand it. And as a team, we understand it and we understand the use cases and we understand people who are going to try to use it and what they're going to do and what they might run into. That didn't answer your question. And now I don't remember what your question is.
This is classic. It was a great answer. So we'll just pretend that I asked something about, you know, eating your own dog food.
When did I recognize the value?
Yes.
Pretty quickly, because we played that dual role, I knew I was going to be managing some customer accounts, but I learned very quickly I would have customers that would ask me for custom documentation. And that was one of the earliest times I realized how valuable it was, because most of the time what they would ask for, we had already documented it somewhere. So I could build them what was effectively custom documentation, only having to write 2 to 3 topics that were specific and unique to them. And the rest of it, I would just pull over from what we already had and I would reuse it, generate, typically they ask for a PDF. So I would just generate a PDF that was, you know, from their perspective, custom documentation, but I'd reused 95% of what we had already written.
Right. That's actually pretty rad. I never realized until just now how meta Heretto, like help.heretto is, because it's documentation about a documentation software written with the, I just never put that together until right now.
I mean, we're not documenting in Google Docs. Like, anything you read on our site is coming from our system.
That's so funny.
And hats off to Gosha and the team for like maintaining it and keeping it up to date, because it is a lot of work and they do a great job with it.
Yeah, absolutely. So you're talking to now in your role, you're talking to a lot of teams who are just starting their journey in maybe looking at a new tool, maybe even adopting a structured content framework. What are some of the things that, you know, people are coming to you and they're in this early phase, what are some of the things that you see the most that would be good for people to consider as they're starting that journey?
Yeah, that's a good question. I work with teams. So for anybody that doesn't know, I'm on the solution side of the sales team now. So I get to see a lot of different teams. Like right before we started this, I was working on probably one of the most complex sets of sample content I've ever seen. So we work with teams that are very advanced, and we work with teams who have never used structured content. And I've seen an influx of teams who have never used structured content starting to move that direction. My suspicion is that it is in large part due to AI tools that are coming around, and people are trying to get content that's more structured, highly semantic, so that these tools can consume that and then provide more accurate answers. So for the teams that have not been in structured content before and they're thinking about going there, I think one of the biggest pieces of advice I can say is you all recognize the pain points that you deal with in your current systems, whatever those may be, whether that's Word, Google Docs, whether it's something that's slightly more structured. There's some pain points into the whole content operations process. Document them and quantify them. And like, start to get down numbers. Like if you spend X amount of time trying to just find content that already exists somewhere, you've written it once, you know it exists somewhere, start a timer and keep track of how long it takes you to find stuff. Like, start to put some real numbers to the pains that you experience regularly, because it's going to give you insight into how much time you're actually generating content versus all the maintenance or even just the annoying things like trying to find it. It gives you some indication of where those things are, how much it's costing you, and that those are numbers you can then take to your management team and say, we're spending X amount of time just looking for things we know exist. We're spending this amount of time updating content. We're only spending this small fraction of time creating new content. And that's all leverage, and it's all powerful information, and it justifies the role that you're playing, but it can also then help justify and offset a cost of moving to a structured content system, because there is going to be cost involved. So the more information you can provide managers about what you're actually doing and the times it's taking, that time is going to translate to dollars.
That's good advice. What is like a common misconception that people have about this industry?
The thing that comes up the most, I think it's that, I don't know that it's a misconception. I think it's just a lack of information. Anytime you move from one format to another, whatever format it is, into whatever format, there's going to be a conversion cost. And because you can do so much with structured content, you can even do quite a bit with Markdown, for that matter, there's still a cost to convert. And there's no system that I know of that handles that automatically. Because there are so many decisions you can make, no structured content tooling is going to impose, at least no tool that I know of is going to force you into a particular information structure. And when you go from an unstructured format into a structured format, you've got to make some decisions about how you want to restructure the content, how you want to break it down into components, and no tool is going to do that automatically for you. So you have to remember that there's going to be some conversion cost, and tools are not going to do it automatically. You can't just upload content and expect it to give you this like beautiful, perfectly structured semantic content on first go. There are tools that can help with that conversion process, but the best way to do it is to have a plan, even if that means working with a consultancy that's going to help you build out that architecture. Start to have it in mind that you're going to have to either invest a lot of time or some time and some money into getting the structure right so that you can hit the ground running in the new tool.
Yeah, a lot more upfront work, but
there's going to be upfront work, and you'll see the payoff down the road for that upfront work. It'll be work to begin with. It requires a lot of attention. You fine tooth comb things once they come into the system, make sure everything's working, whatever system it is. But that upfront cost pays dividends down the road.
Yeah. What are some of the like most interesting things that you're seeing people do not necessarily like in our system, but in documentation in general?
A lot of people are starting to take, they know that that their documentation does tend to be like, they consider it gold standard for information about their products. I've seen a shift in the last 9 years in here where people are starting to move from documentation is this supplemental helpful information about our products to it has to be part of what we consider the product itself. So for people to be successful, it's got to be well documented if they're going to use our tools. So I've seen the shift towards moving to like considering documentation to be gold standard, and even an additional feature of the product as it comes with all this information. Some teams charge for that, some don't. We don't. Ours is available. Some teams do. So they put their entire documentation behind login or paywall or something like that. But in that shift, what we're seeing is people are starting to leverage it more and more and more, in more accessible ways. So a lot of people are moving towards like some type of a chatbot or something that will needs to pull information and answers from that technical documentation because it is the gold standard. So we're seeing a lot of people that are, if not already implemented, they're at least thinking we need our tech pubs to be available and consumable so that we could serve it up in these very small snippets to people when they're looking for answers. At minimum, point them in the right direction.
Yeah, I think a lot of the like in-app, in-product implementations I've seen lately are really killer. It's not just,
yeah,
here's a link to our documentation. It's like, no, I notice you're on this page and you're trying to click this button. Here's information about this, like very specifically in what they're trying to do at the moment. And I think that that's just going to continue to expand. And it's so cool to see.
I mean, ACS Technologies is still one of the coolest implementations of that I've seen with our customer group. You know, they gave me login to a demo instance and to be able to log into their application and click around in it. And then if I get stuck somewhere or I'm just testing something, I can hit the help button and I'll get somewhere between 3 to 6 hits that are about the particular page of their application that I'm on. So I never have to leave their application to find information about it and how to use it, which is really cool.
Yeah, I constantly am blown away by how advanced and innovative ACS Technologies is.
Yeah.
And it's just wild. Like their use of personalization when they're, you know, talking to Catholics about priests, but then changing it for Baptist and Methodist ministries to pastor. Like, it's just such a you would never think that church software would be this innovative, but they really are. They're like ahead of the curve.
They are. And, you know, hats off always to Barbara on that team.
Absolutely.
Because she and I were talking about this particular use case 5 years ago, and she was thinking about it before it became something that a lot of companies were thinking about. And like, she was already headed that direction with it, at least as a vision state. That's where she was, you know, five years ago, which is
absolutely
cool.
And she's just like the coolest person.
She's lovely.
Wonderful.
Anytime I get a chance to talk to Barbara, it's like my day is going to be better when it's after I talk to her.
Same. And for anyone listening right now, if you haven't listened to Barbara's episode, it is incredible. It was actually the first one that we ever published. So I would go back and listen to it because she talks a lot more about what they're doing. And then you'll see why we say she's just so lovely.
Yes.
Okay, cool. So you have written a lot of documentation. You've seen a lot of documentation. What does great documentation mean to you?
That's a really tough question, because I tend to be very pragmatic about these things. So for me, I always consider like, what's your end goal? What's the vision for what you guys want to do? And are you successfully achieving that goal with minimal amounts of friction in the content operations process? So that's kind of a non-answer for you. But that's really what it is. So like, can you get done what you need to get done, what your users are expecting, and can you do it with the minimal amount of stress and pain in that process? And I mean, as we all know, stress and pain tends to equate to like, there's some cost benefit to that, you know, and it could be actual dollars in time spent. So I don't know. I don't have a great answer for you there.
It's fair. You come from it from a different view, and I always appreciate that. That's why we do this.
Yeah, I mean, my job's great. Like, I get to come in and I get to offer solutions and hopeful things. And I'll be honest, and that's one thing, that's there are two main reasons I'm still at this company after 9 years. One is the team. And two, I am encouraged to be upfront and honest with people about what we can't do. And those two things combined make this job great. So I get to come in and offer mostly good news. Occasionally I have to say, no, we don't do X, Y, Z. And then I move on to the next one.
Yeah. Just moving on.
Yeah.
What
that's
is
not
something...
to say all of the past prospective customers who are now customers, that's not to say I don't love you. I just have lots of new ones that I've got to work on too.
Yeah, it's true. And I mean, man, like there's so many new, I think it's really exciting to see, and I speak 100% for myself, but I do also see this uptick in people who are turning towards structured content. I think you're right that AI is a big catalyst for that. But it's fun to see all these people who were kind of like me when I started at Heretto and didn't really know what this world was about, didn't really understand that there was like a language here that you had to learn and there was a structure for this. And then to see new teams who were discovering this for the first time start to unlock their like, oh, we've felt this pain forever. Like we've been copying and pasting this one paragraph forever. And like to be able to see their eyes light up when they realize that they don't have to do that anymore in this world is really exciting. It's fun to see.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, you know, for teams who are new, one of the biggest aha moments, if I'm showing them how to do XYZ, some kind of reuse, one of the typical examples that I'll show is like, here's a snippet of legal text that has to be in every document you have. And when I can show them how I updated in a single location and now all the documents are updated and they just hit the republish button, that's the moment where a lot of them are like, oh my gosh, that's so much easier. And they're like, so do we have to go review all those documents now? And I'm like, well, you can, but really the only thing you changed was that one bit. So review that. And if it's good, the rest of them are good. Like, it's not different in those other files. You changed one file.
Well, and I'm sure that's like especially big on a legal thing where you're usually having to say as of the certain year. So every year on the first of the year, you change that one piece and you're done. Like it's not a big deal anymore.
Yeah.
How funny. I never thought about that because we do that on the marketing side as well. You know, like all of our, it's all copywritten based on a certain year. So it's those little things that are the most interesting to me.
What do you think is the most understood, misunderstood, or understood about coming into this space? Because you came in as green as I did.
Yeah.
And now you've been here for a while.
A while. Uh-huh. I think it's that I think it's a misunderstanding that people have about themselves. Like I talk a lot to technical writers directly. I mean, obviously that's what this whole podcast is about. And so I think that like they've been told so much that like their work isn't valuable, but it really is. Like it is truly the center of some of companies, especially if you're software, especially if you're like B2C where you don't necessarily have a sales function that has a long process where you're getting a lot of face time with someone. If you're B2C, your documentation is just as important as your marketing information, as your social media presence, as all of that stuff. As like, as a marketer, I can definitely recognize that our help site gets just as much, if not more traffic than our actual marketing site. Because once a customer is a customer, they are rarely actually going to your marketing site. Like they don't care. Right. They've already been there. And so your help site is where you then get to continuously engage with these people. And that customer experience is just so pivotal that, and I know innately we all know this, but I don't see enough people talking about with other people in their companies or other people in their world and their ecosystems that like what they do is actually incredibly important. And it's not just words on a page. It's not just an afterthought in product. Like, it matters a lot. And I don't think they have, I don't think we've found the way to help them understand, or I don't know. I think that there's just something that there's a disconnect between, I know that the people in our industry feel that, we know that, but we have not found the way to properly communicate that so that other people understand it too.
Yeah. I think
that
that's
was,
right.
I was fairly long-winded, but from my perspective, that's what I see. Also, that like little baby things on your help site, as someone who's done multiple help site assessments, and like that's something I really enjoy and love doing, there are so many tiny things that could be such big wins that people just like, they don't think that they're big enough to handle right now. And so they don't.
Yeah.
And I kind of wish that they would follow the, like in house cleaning, there's a rule that like, if you can do it in 5 seconds, do it. Don't put it off to tomorrow. And that's kind of like help site stuff. Like if you can do it in, you know, an hour, you should probably just go ahead and tackle it because it could make a big difference.
Yeah. And I think that if we, I mean, we all talk about this just in our own lives, like little things really do matter. Like if you do little things well, then it's going to add up. This is one of my it's a classic. Anytime I sit in on when the development team is demoing new things that they're building and they're like, oh yeah, I have this little thing. Oh, it's small. I changed this. And I'm like, oh my gosh, that's amazing. As somebody who uses the system, like that is, you're underselling the importance of that. And maybe they don't recognize the actual importance of it, but it's one of those things to remember. Something you might consider small and insignificant could be really helpful and really beneficial to someone else because they live in a different world. They work in a different environment every day. And that little thing could be really important. That's something
Absolutely.
We have to remember too, obviously.
Yeah. I mean, that's like a life philosophy, right? Like it's the little things that matter. And that I think is just as important in a company's day to day.
Yeah, agreed.
Okay. So let's get into some of the more like fun stuff. The more Jared specific things. What is something
I was
outside
born
of
on a cold November morning. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, exactly. In Oklahoma, is that correct?
Yep, that's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
All right. I don't need to know the like origin story of Jared, but do you have actually, you know what is like your favorite childhood memory?
So there was this little, my friend lived right by the little woods, and there was this cool, you know, cool for a 7, 8 year old. It was like a kid built little bike track in the woods, and we would take our bikes there. And I remember like we would hit these, what we thought were these really big jumps, and we're probably getting like, you know, an inch or two off the ground, but we'd be like, whoa, did you see that air? And it was awesome. And then it's like, there was a creek there too. So we'd like play in the creek, and yeah, I'd get poison ivy all the time, all the time. Yeah, it was great.
That's part of childhood that I just don't think a lot of kids now understand, but man, it's the best. I was also a
Not
creek
the poison
and
ivy
woods
part.
kid.
That's not great.
No,
But
no. Poison ivy's not fun. Which is actually a great segue. Speaking of getting major air on bicycles, what is something outside of work that you're passionate about?
I mean, climbing is like personally, obviously my family is way more important than climbing, but like climbing is the thing that has been, it's the biggest through line of my life. Like it started at age 14 or 15. I don't know. Still doing it. And
how did you actually get into climbing?
I watched Cliffhanger when I was 14 with a friend, and I was like, we can do that. You know, like young and brash, you don't know anything. And so obviously it's not even really a climbing movie. It like, there's so many things in that movie that are not real. But as a 14-year-old who isn't a climber, you don't know that. So we watched the movie after school one day, and then he was like, my dad's got a rope in the garage. And I was like, yes. So we went and it's like a tow rope for a vehicle. And there was this abandoned rock quarry, like a few minutes from where we lived. So we went out there and we like wrapped the rope around the tree a couple of times. And then he was like, you go first. And I was like, oh, okay. And I wrapped the rope around myself a couple of times. This is really dumb. And then started like lowering myself off the edge of this like 20-foot cliff on this tiny little tree. And then we were both like, maybe we should get some like real equipment. So we did. We went in like Bass Pro Shops and bought whatever they had. And then we started rappelling off of like anything we could find, like water towers. Like we would sneak out of the house at 3 o'clock in the morning and like drive to a water tower and climb it and like set up the rope and like rappel off of it. And then finally we just got bored with that because you can only rappel up so many things until you're like, it's basically the same every time. And then one time we were like, let's try to climb up this cliff. So then we started climbing up.
I like that your first instinct was to go over and down and not up.
It's
That's
just like gravity
amazing.
do its thing, right?
What has been you've done a lot in climbing. Like you're not just I would say you're a little bit more than just a hobby climber. Like you've done a lot of really cool things in terms of like the climbing culture. So what's some of your favorite like routes that you've created? Some of your favorite moments? Like give me those.
I mean, the most well documented was a route that a friend and I did in Utah. It was like right place, right time kind of thing. There was a film project happening about the park, and so we ended up being like the climbing team in the film. That one got like the most press, but the one that I'm probably most proud of is the one we just finished in California. There's a piece of rock. Kind of on the, it's outside of Yosemite, but it's only a couple of miles from the park boundary. It's called the Incredible Hulk, and it's about a 1,600-1,800 foot tower. And my friend and I climbed a new route there. It's about, I think it's our route's about 1,600 feet, and that one was a lot of work. It was like three trips. Each trip in was like 60 to 80 pound backpacks to get all our gear up there, and then it took us three trips to finally put it all together and finish it. And it's probably the best first ascent that I've been on.
Wow. Do you have plans or have you, one, it's actually twofold. Have you ever re-climbed a route that you put up? And then two, do you have plans to go back to this one?
I have plans to go back there. No plans right now to climb it again. I mean, I would. It's fun. And it's all really well equipped. There's good anchors everywhere. I haven't climbed the one in Utah again. It's a little more adventurous. It's for real. It's technically a little easier, but it's definitely more high adventure. Like it's scarier. It's got questionable gear while you're climbing it, so the chances for big falls is pretty high. And it's got some loose rock on it. So it's not like we wanted to put up a route there that was consistent with Zion climbing.
I
And
see.
our friend who's a local who wrote the guidebook for climbing there, he got on it with us for part of it, and he was like, yeah, man, this thing's for real. He's like, this isn't a route just anybody should come climb. He was like, you better know what you're doing if you're going to get on this one. And that's what we wanted out of it. We wanted something that stuck true to the nature of Zion climbing, and it's an adventure for sure.
Fair.
I do want to go do that one again just because it's adventure.
I see. Yeah. And like you don't get enough of that sitting and talking about technical documentation all day.
The funny thing about that route is it's you can see the road. You're maybe a quarter of a mile from the canyon road. So like you'll see the shuttles going by with a bunch of tourists, and you can be on that route and having just a terrifying day and like stressed out of your mind and see these people just walking down the road having like a really relaxed day, and you're up there like losing your mind because you're like, I don't want this to be the end. Yeah, it's hilarious, like the putting those two experiences so close together. Because like in California, you're out. You're 7 mile hike in, and nobody is going to be out there except unless it's another climber. But in Zion, you're looking at tourists. Or the other thing, there's a hiking trail that goes along the top of the cliff line right beside that route. So you're on the last section, and it's hard and scary up there. And there are people who are on a hike who are like sitting there just watching you, and like they're on flat ground, perfectly fine, and you're like, yeah.
You're like having a near-death experience, and these people are like, wow, that looks like so much fun.
Yeah, and they're trying to talk to you in the middle of it too, because I mean you're only 50 yards away at most, and they're like trying to have conversations with you, and you're stressed.
Oh my gosh. That's when it's like perfectly okay to be like, I need you to be quiet now.
Yeah.
One wrong move and you're going to watch me die. So if you don't want to do that, then please be quiet.
Yeah, hopefully it's not that serious, but it could be.
Well, you never
Oh.
know with you, Jared, let's be honest. So I don't, I'm not, no comment.
Yeah.
Okay. We are nearing the end of our time. And, you know, we could sit here and talk for hours because we often do, but I asked this
We also
question.
work.
We
We
do,
also we
absolutely.
work. Yeah.
Yeah, we work. But we just have a really good time while we do it.
We do.
So if I ask this question to every single person and I get a lot of really fun responses, so no pressure. But if there was one hill that you were willing to die on in this industry, what would it be?
It's probably going to be this is just based off of like time here. I said I'm real pragmatic about most of these things. This one is the one I tend to not be pragmatic about, and that's use an open standard format. Even Word is ubiquitous, but it's not open standard. The reason that open standards are lovely is because no vendor controls that standard. That's something I think that we have adhered to very, very well and spent a lot of time and a lot of money to make sure that our system adheres to the open standard, DITA standard. And we stick to that standard very strictly. And that provides a lot of flexibility down the road. Like, God forbid somebody doesn't want to use our system anymore and they want to move out. Fine, download your content and go put it, it's your content, go put it in another system. That system might make some tweaks to it. But the standard allows that kind of flexibility and portability. It makes the migration process easier because there's nothing custom about it. That was one thing I loved about my schoolwork. I could use when I was using LaTeX for writing, it's just a standard markup language. Nobody controls it. No single person or industry or tool controls it. So when I was writing, I could write my academic work. I could use VS Code. I could use any of the, I used probably six different LaTeX editors trying to find the one that I liked. And each of them, I could just open it and load my document and start working on it. So using an open standard provides you a lot more flexibility in what you want to do. And that's probably the hill I would die on is like, being forced into something that's proprietary would be that would be difficult for me.
Okay, one last one. If you could wave like a magic wand and have one thing either fixed or appear or like whatever it is in technical documentation, what would you want from that wand?
If I could wave a wand, I would wave it over anybody who's a manager of tech pubs teams or anybody that's above that level, like director level, I would automatically implant in them the understanding that not the understanding, but I would want them to be able to comprehend the importance of what their teams are doing, even though it's technical and complicated and sometimes can have, depending on the size of the company and what they want to do, these things can get very expensive. I would want them to understand the importance of it because it is genuinely important. And I don't talk to those directors or C-level people a lot, but when I do, they're thinking big picture and vision. And sometimes are not as interested in the details about how things get from point A to point B because they're tasked with thinking about the vision, and that's great. We need people to do that for sure. They're trying to weigh some really difficult things, the vision with the cost and all of these different things. And it's tough sometimes to help them understand that the details are really important in these cases. You have big companies, you have big software companies that will promise a lot, and they do so in grand terms, and they can skate over the technical pieces of it because one, people don't have the mental space for that. Like we're busy. Everybody's busy. And the downfall to that is not understanding those technical pieces can lead you to make a poor decision for the rest of the team. So I've seen people that have, I've seen directors, executives who have squashed technical documentation plans because they see a price tag associated with it. And they don't understand that to get some of the customer facing functionality that they want, they need to take those things into account. And they just don't have this mental space to try to understand what's required to achieve those ends. It's not a knock on them. It's just it's a lot. It can be a lot. So maybe I guess the best way to say it is, if I could wave a wand, I would want directors, executives, I would want them to trust their teams to make the right decisions.
Yep. I was muted through most of that, but nodding very aggressively to everything that Jared said. Thank you. I'm glad you did. Because I 100% agree. Thank you very much, Jared. This was very Thanks, lovely. Ryan. I appreciate you being on Behind the Docs.
Always happy to be here.
Thanks for listening to Behind the Docs, where the content's structured, but the conversations aren't. If you enjoyed this episode, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and share it with someone who loves great documentation as much as we do. Until next time, keep creating content that makes a difference.